Peter Ward with us, and we're going to take your phone calls as we talk about the possibility of these earth catastrophes, so check in with us. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Peter Ward with us. Peter, the Indonesian tsunami of several years ago that killed over 200,000 people, did they have much warning at all?
No. And that was, again, this really bizarre tectonic shift. As you know, a huge hunk of the seabed through an earthquake mechanism just simply descended about 10 feet, I believe it was. But its volume was so big, an enormous amount of water was suddenly began to move. There was no warning whatsoever on that one beyond the earthquake. So people just had minutes.
The only one that knew were the animals. They seemed to head for the high hills.
Yeah, a friend of mine, Joel Kirschfink at Caltech, for years was using honeybees for attempting to predict earthquakes. And his studies suggested that, indeed, honeybees had a sense of when earthquakes were going to happen. You know well, of course, the dogs start barking in advance. But this was the first time I ever heard that there were insects that could also have a sense of intended earthquakes.
Did the animals feel and sense something like vibrations that humans can't pick up?
Yeah, I'm not an expert at all on this, on just what I read. But there's certainly some low-frequency, low-waves moving through either the earth or airwaves themselves that animals can detect. Just as a shark, for instance, they have a lateral line system. They can detect pressure waves in the ocean that we can't feel at all. Well, there's got to be other senses the animals have that we haven't even discovered yet.
Would the hot springs around the Yellowstone start bubbling before there's any kind of problem there?
Maybe, but that's what's so mystifying about these things, because every situation is different. It's all about what's the nature of the water moving underneath that whole gigantic failed caldera, this really complicated geology. And so there's no way you can go from one place to another and say, aha, because that happened, we know an eruption is imminent. But there are generalizations. There will always be an increase in earthquakes. There should be a change in groundwater, its temperature, its chemistry, much about the water as it gets heated by the rising magma. So there are lots of signs, but, you know, it's a very inexact thing. And we keep saying, look, this Tonga volcano, it's like nothing we've ever seen.
Exactly.
All the volcanoes that have gone off and all the times humans have been watching. But NASA showed that there was this vertical pulse way up into the highest part of the atmosphere. There was something they hadn't seen, and George had been trying to figure out what it was about this. There's some aspect of it's an underwater volcano, and there was a sudden influx of very cold water getting very hot magma in just such a way that it caused this intense explosion that was vertical. So once again, we keep thinking, oh, we've seen everything, right? Well, no, there's so much more to learn.
Isn't there a volcano near La Palma that, if it goes, could create a tsunami to wipe out the eastern coast of the United States?
Well, there certainly is evidence that there are a number of different fault blocks and geological units out there that they think might slide in from shallower water to deeper water. And once again, once you get big enough pieces of rock to move, then you really do cause it. But, you know, where I live, not you, you're in L.A., but that's a scary enough place.
Yeah, exactly.
The earthquake hazard in L.A. is nothing compared to what it is in Seattle. So we, as well as places in Chile, have these deep, deep subduction earthquakes facing us. Seattle will be hit by probably a 7 or an 8 earthquake. And again, it's just a matter of time till that happens. Anybody who lives in Seattle is risking their life every single day, and the risk is way higher here than many other places in the world. What can you do? You just say you keep living.
We had a guest who has passed on from the Seattle area, Stuart Wild, and he had been predicting for years a major earthquake in the Seattle area, for years.
Well, he's not wrong, and certainly people in my department and University of Washington, a really great scientist named Brian Atwater was the person who first saw that there were areas around Seattle that had been raised up to 10 feet, huge blocks of geology raised up, and he was able to date these. And this is where he was able to discover that these superquakes happen about every 200 years, and once again, we are due.
Let's go back to the phones now. Let's go west of the Rockies to start. Kenny's with us in Yucca, Arizona. Hi, Kenny.
Hi, George. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, sir.
I have a question, two questions. The first one is, okay, how does all that ash get up through all that water into the atmosphere? And the second question is, what about the Mammoth Caldera? L.A. gets most of their water, or a large portion of their drinking water, and from that area where the caldera is located.
Is that, where does the Colorado River go through, Peter?
Well, the Colorado River, as we know, it certainly goes through a lot of different geological units. But the complication of it all is that some of them are sedimentary, so layered rocks, but others are all big pieces of the bedrock of North America. So the Rocky Mountains and the Great Batholiths, they're part of it. So you've got a very complicated geology. But what really is affecting the Colorado as much as anything else is how many different human groups are taking the water and causing that river now to hold entirely different amounts of pressure and chemical stuff going into it. But it's just the usage and the siphoning off that affects groundwater everywhere. And so it's a very complicated situation, highly unpredictable. What we do know is the Southwest keeps growing, and it was a desert, and it was never supposed to be the place where you had so many humans living there. But again, it's a beautiful place to be, and that water is being used and used up.
And a caldera is basically an inverted volcano, isn't it?
Yeah, a caldera is simply a bowl itself, and quite often they're collapsed. So you can have a big volcano, and then there's all kinds of earthquakes, of course. Parts of the geology fail. They fall in on themselves into very complicated structures. And Yellowstone is an enormous caldera. I mean, that's a gigantic basin that has been caused by these. George, as you called it, every 600 to 700,000 years, since 2 million years ago, this thing has been popping off. So we've had three of these. They're absolutely climate changing. I'm very curious, George, about the 2 million years ago, one of the biggest of all eruptions. And the way we predict how big it was, or at least quantify it, we can discover the thickness of the ash, how much ash was blown into the air. So those are calculations and measurements that are made. Man, that 2 million year old Yellowstone event was world-changing.
Jeez.
2 million years ago, it's just when our group, Homo, the very early species of Homo, first started appearing. And people are wondering, how often have these super, super volcanic events, which perturb the climate of the entire planet, create huge evolutionary change? It may not be far-fetched to say that perhaps something about us, our humanity, the fact that Homo was the very first and most intelligent of these anthropoid apes, that maybe we are a legacy of a volcanic, huge Yellowstone super eruption.
And Kenny wanted to know what pushes the ash up when water should be knocking it down.
Well, you've got the pressure down below, of course. It's just like if you boil water, you see it turn into steam really fast, and steam locomotives have used that principle forever. So you have this super, super molten rock, cold seawater hits it, or groundwater hits it, turns to steam instantly, and steam expands. So it's the whole principle behind steam engines, that it just blasts upward.
Back to Yellowstone for a moment. Do we know why it's not on its timetable this time? Thank God.
Well, again, it's the Earth has its own sort of stuff. We know that there's a hot spot, and that hot spot has been, the Earth is passing over something far deeper and something far, far more ancient, a conduit into the deeper parts of the Earth through plate tectonics. The North American continent, very thin skin, has been driving to the west over this, and so that hot spot essentially, it looks like it keeps going east. You know, this was way closer to the coast 2 million years ago. So it will keep moving towards the east. The Yellowstone hotspot itself will make a new type of caldera in probably a couple million more years as it heads into the Midwest of North America. unless, of course, the continent stops or plate tectonics changes course. But it's a very predictable thing. And if you're looking at hundreds of thousand-year intervals of time, for us, trying to figure out next year or 5 years or 100 years from now, it's not predictable.
Let's go to Bill, truck driving in Tennessee. Hey, Bill, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Hey, Peter. You know, I actually live in Federal Way, but I'm truck driving in Tennessee. And I just had a couple of questions, if you don't mind. The first is on this lunar standstill. And I'm wondering, is it actually in the 2030s with the tide effect of it added to the rising sea level? Is it actually going to put some of these at-risk islands? Is it actually going to make them uninhabitable? And then my other question is about 1958, the mega tsunami that hit Kataya Bay in Alaska. That joker was 1,700 feet high.
Wow.
Now I'm wondering, but is it 1,700 feet, like, eventually? Like, is it, like, wave after wave and it just keeps growing? Or is it literally a 1,700-foot-high wall of water? Because that's scary.
Well, I think the one you're talking about, the Great Alaska Earthquake, I thought that was 1960 or the early 60s. I don't remember it being 58. Certainly the wave wasn't that high. It wasn't 1,000 feet high. In places like in Hilo, I think it might have been 10 feet, some places 6 feet, 4 feet. But it's the incredible thing that really struck me, George, in looking at the videos of the Indonesian tsunami you talked about. The videos, when it comes in, it just didn't look that impressive at first. I kept thinking, how could that sort of just that inexorable movement of water? But I mean, that's the point. It just kept going, right? It isn't like a wave that slaps the shore and went away. It hits the shore and it just kept going and going, and the water kept rising and rising.
Yeah.
It wasn't so much a tidal wave as a tidal wall. In the Alaska case, I think what we're seeing is...
And that was 64, by the way, Peter.
Okay, thank you. I knew it was early 60s. I know it's a movement, and I don't think it ever got to 1,700 feet, but it certainly pushed into some of these river valleys, and just through the amplification effect, it would have been amplified and gone up into some of these deep valleys to fairly good elevation. But boy, that Alaska quake was, I was a little boy, but that was a spooky monster.
And what about the uninhabitability of some of these places when it happens? It will be years, if not forever, right?
Yeah, no, that's definitely the case. The sea level is not going down. I mean, we've got this pretty inexorable part. Sea level is, at this point, has been at a very low state for, as we know, at least in terms of geological time, abnormally low for the last 2.5 billion years. The ice ages, which we've just come out of, so much water was turned into ice that caused sea level to drop so low. But through most of geological history, it's 100 to 200 feet higher than that. And we're just moving back into what is pretty much the steady state, the default of sea level. We've been in a very strange case with so much ice. Well, that ice is going away.
Let's go to first-time caller Colleen in Eureka, Montana. Hello, Colleen. Go ahead.
Hello. For decades, we've heard of underground cities being built by the government on the East Coast, and there's one in particular in Colorado with 10 to 15 feet of ash. How long would an underground city be helpful if Yellowstone blew, and why would anyone put an underground city right next to the enormous Yellowstone caldera?
If there is one. Peter, what do you think?
I've never heard of underground cities. Boy, if they're there, it would sure help us out. If we get to the point where Yellowstone goes, any sort of port in any storm is going to be very useful.
Of course, they'd be buried in forever, too, wouldn't they?
Oh, yeah. Well, again, It is unimaginable what happens to society if Yellowstone goes. And again, we give people warning. Where do they go? I mean, how do you tell 150 million people in the eastern half of the United States? Well, by the way,
to evacuate, you can't.
Where do you go? Exactly. Where do you go? There's no place to go.
Let's go to Pat, Lachine, Michigan, east of the Rockies. Hey, Pat, go ahead.
Hey, thank you, George.
Thank you.
Yeah, my thought, I got a couple, three of them, if you bear with me. One's on the polar shift, one's on the methane production, but the main one is on the volcanic things that's going on in Yellowstone and whatnot. Back during the first 2 years of the Trump administration, remember Kim Jong-il, the little rocket man in South Korea there? He had a madman scientist laboratory in the bottom of a volcano, and he decided he didn't want to get caught red-handed, so he blew it. I mean, he exploded the volcano, closed a pimple in the earth, i.e. a vent, on the Pacific Ring of Fire. Now, my question is, and the Yellowstone... There was a lake in Yellowstone, I recollect, just about 6 weeks after this Kim Jong-il thing. There's a southern shore on a lake that the lake bed on the, not the lake, but the shoreline on one side rose like 6 feet.
Wow.
The pimple was fixing to bust. And Billings, Montana, I mean, it was only 300 yards up the riverbed there. It would have been blown to smithereens.
Can you, what if you sent a nuke into the caldera? What would happen out there, Peter?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I think, again, when I was a boy, and we, the United States, wanted a peaceful use of nuclear weapons. And at that time, George, you might remember this too. We were talking about using nuclear weapons to build canals. So it could be all this great. We could blow these things up and make big canals in a very useful way. But volcanoes have their own sort of timing here. I think if we put all the nuclear weapons we had deep down into a volcano and blew them up, you'd certainly have some local earthquakes. But the whole tectonic plates, the entire sort of heat pushing of the earth, wouldn't be affected at all. These are much bigger clock springs working this clock. And we can do a little local thing. Kim's on in. Uden could have blown up all he wanted to, and I doubt he would have much effect on sort of the entire heat budget of the planet.
And Pat, you had a question about the polar caps? Go ahead.
You read my mind on that last one. I was thinking, why couldn't we do a little low-level drilling or some small-level nukes and relieve some pimples in the ocean bed, so to speak, you know what I mean? But, yeah, as far as the tectonic plate shift, I'm wondering how much that has to do with the things that are getting blamed on climate change. And as far as the methane, we have been damming up the rivers for over 100 years in this country. And whenever you get a mud flat, it produces methane. I used to call them turtle farts when my kids were out camping. They'd be walking along the edge of the creek and they'd see these bubbles coming up. What are them? Oh, them's turtle farts.
Well, probably is interesting. That you're absolutely true about the damming of rivers and how we're affecting gas exchange. But one of the scary deals now is methane is frozen in the high north, and they call it a cloth rate. And what we're seeing now is much of the permafrost melt is that there are frozen methane deposits which are coming out of that frozen point and turning into gas. And so, George, you were asking a lot about, you know, what is the contribution of various components to what we call global warming, but which is actually just the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. But so much of it is natural. The warming creates a melting of the cloth rates of the methane that was in the atmosphere that causes more warming. So we have huge natural deposits of greenhouse gases that are being released simply by even a slight warming causes it to get a little warmer, and then it gets a little warmer.
And things start to melt. Peter, we're going to come back and take final calls with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we're not going to debunk moon landings at all, but we're going to talk about the reasons why there is a growing skepticism about the landings with Marcus Allen. He's the United Kingdom publisher of Nexus Magazine, and we're going to find out his thoughts on that. So get ready for that. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie back with Peter Ward. Peter, is there anything we've been talking about tonight that would surprise you if it happened?
Well, Yeah, it would surprise me if nothing happened. I mean, just the fact the calm before the storm just seems to be the way the world is working. George, imagine we'd had this conversation, because we've been talking for a lot of years, before COVID hit. It was what happened just is incomprehensible. You hear about, you pay lip service, oh, there could be big diseases or whatever. But back in 2019, none of us saw this coming.
Not
what
like
has
this.
Happened in the last couple of years?
It's been devastating.
It has been, and it was unpredictable. This is why I'm old enough now that almost nothing surprises me in the natural world anymore. And the beautiful thing is that strange things keep happening. This Tonga volcano and the beautiful pictures that you can see from space. I'm just hoping good things happen, and we should celebrate one really good thing that happened, the giant new space telescope, which had to undergo hundreds of just crazy mechanical movements, is now sitting happily in place.
A million miles out there.
A million miles, and it's in this place called a Lagrange point. It's balanced by the Earth and the Moon in such a perfect way. It's going to sit there.
And it's working.
Hopefully, we've got one last thing to do. We've got to align all the mirrors. But I think the conversations you and I could have, because I intend to live for a long time and hopefully get the back of this show, in the next 6 months, as they start looking at stuff, entirely new topics, entirely new understanding is going to come through. So let's celebrate some good news, because there's so much that isn't good news these days.
Next up, Morris in Youngstown, Ohio. Welcome to the show. Hi, Morris.
Yes, thank you, George.
Sure thing.
How are you?
Good.
Mount St. Helens, I don't know if you remember the story. There was an old man was named Harry Truman, and they were trying to convince Harry to leave because that volcano is going to erupt. And the reporters couldn't convince him. Somebody sent somebody down the store to get a fifth of bourbon, and they waved it, and he let him into his house and showed him to play a piano. They asked him, say, Harry, what's going to take for you to leave? He said it would take 3 acts of Congress, an act of God. Oh. He says Congress doesn't move very fast nowadays, and God isn't answering. But he had a relative that wrote a book about his life. He was quite a different person.
Was he one of those who died in the 57?
Oh, yeah.
I think it was 1977.
It was 1980, actually, wasn't it, Peter?
1980, and he is every bit of his cellular stuff is crushed and gone. He's down in a lake that no longer exists under tons and tons and tons of volcanic rubble.
What was it like in Pompeii?
Boy, isn't that a great question? I love books about it. Even the movies, I devour those things. My mom was a wannabe archaeologist, so I was raised along with dinosaurs and stories. And Pompeii was one of the coolest and the greatest. But just like David Johnston, he only had a few seconds. But Pliny the Elder, one of the great naturalists, sat in his villa right across the bay from the volcano, and he saw it explode, and he was killed and destroyed. And he would have had minutes and minutes to do this, to see this, to know, hopefully, you know, maybe I won't die, but just the sky getting black and the first bomb starting to fall and the ash, what was it like in Pompeii?
Let's go to Danny in Oklahoma City. Hello, Danny. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, George. Good to talk to you. Very interesting. I've got a couple of quick questions. My first one is kind of like Mount St. Helens when it went off in 80. I was a very young man at the time, about 17 years old or so, and living here in Oklahoma, and like you do part of the time in St. Louis. My first question to Peter is there really assuming we had a warning a day or two to maybe flee to South Florida or Texas, or, you know, would that be a better place for refuge to escape a lot of the fallout? And the number two is, are there other known calderas in the world that have gone off, say, in our lifetime, you know, that are not cone-shaped?
I don't think anything has gone off yet, Peter. Do you?
I just to be ready for this, because I do respect my host, I pulled up a big graph of all the biggest volcanic explosions in the last 300 years. Well, in fact, St. Helens was pretty small compared to some of these others. Mount Katmai in Alaska in 1912 was enormous compared to St. Helens. Krakatoa, of course, in 1883 was one of the biggest. The biggest of all that we've had in historic times was Tambora. But what spooks me so much is this haunted volcano. They knew it was there, but blowing up once in a while, but nothing this catastrophically. But how many more of these underwater volcanoes are out there? The fact that this was so unbelievably, crazily strong, for as small as it was, has to do with the fact it was completely underwater, the particular part that blew up. All the seawater rushed in, heated up, and then there was the explosion of the steam. So back to your question, it all depends on where downwind is on the day the thing goes off. And prevailing winds generally go from the west to the east. But how many more of these volcanoes underwater are there which could go off just unexpectedly? I mean, that's the mystery.
That is indeed the mystery. The ones above ground, you at least can see them.
Absolutely. And that's why this thing was such a surprise.
Next up, let's go to Tony, driving in North Carolina. Welcome to the show. Hi, Tone.
Hi, George. Nice talking to you again.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, I have a question regarding the caldera. What is the chances of it being a big major eruption or just a burp?
Well, that's an interesting question, Peter.
Yeah, much better chance of a burp. I mean, little stuff happens all the time, and boy, we hope for burps. Burps release pressure. That's the nice thing. It's like earthquakes. You know, we want there to be lots of little earthquakes in Southern California, because then there won't be a big earthquake. And it's the same with volcanoes. It's how much of this magma that is building up before you can release pressure on it. And we, again, it's just, you know, we've been studying volcanoes for so long, and geology is really still pretty new science. The prediction for volcanoes isn't very good. People for a long time thought it was going to be Mount Baker. No one was saying, when I was growing up, like, up in Seattle, no one was saying it's going to be Mount St. Helens. We didn't know that until all of a sudden all the eruptions started. We got all the earthquakes. But Mount Baker was the one everybody looked at. And the scariest, of course, is Mount Rainier. If that monster goes, then you're really going to lose an awful lot of the cities on the rivers. Tacoma, Washington, is just downstream from this, and Tacoma would be in terrible shape.
When you say mount in front of a word, does that mean volcano? When you say Mount St. Helens, Mount Rainier?
Oh, yes, yes. That's a great point. I mean, there are lots of things called Mount Blanc, but for every cascade, it's about that. And yes, they are all volcanoes here. We have, not a volcano, obviously a different kind of rock. But again, where I live, it's all volcanoes all the time.
Joe, Long Island, New York. Hello, Joseph. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Peter. I want to ask you about the major rivers in India all originate in Tibet, controlled by China. What is issues are being generated by that at this time?
Well, the biggest issues, of course, are that a lot of countries are fighting for that limited amount of water. And because of climate change, we know the snow in the Himalayas keeps getting at higher and higher elevations, and that's an issue all over the planet. But because of that, the way the water is now running off and down into these various countries, that it's just a setup for political problems. I mean, how many of the wars that we're going to see in the 21st century are going to be over fresh water?
Many.
Probably many. So, again, your question is just so stupid. We are really looking at enormous political instability. I mean, you've seen in Nepal and Kashmir, the Chinese and the Indians, so they are now weapon to weapon. And it is largely because of water. I mean, you're absolutely right. It is the flash flood.
We're taking final calls with Peter Ward as we talk about the calderas and volcanoes and earthquakes and all these things that could affect our lifestyle. And as you have said, Peter, it could happen at any time.
Oh, absolutely.
So, for, you know, for one to say in this lifespan, it's not going to happen when I'm alive, it could happen.
Well, it just goes to show we see so many villains, you know, there's just no sense of negativity. Don't they often say it's the one you aren't watching that comes and gets you? It'd be kind of ironic if we're so scared about climate change and diseases, and then we have the super volcano blow up, and, well, sorry, you should have looked at me. No, I guess that's not funny.
Let's go to Radon in San Rafael, California, west of the Rockies. Hi, Radon.
Hi, George. Hey, that was great. You played Buffalo Springfield the other night.
Yes, we did.
Yeah. Hi, I wanted to ask your guest, how much do you think these chemtrails are heating up the atmosphere?
What do you know about chemtrails, Peter? Anything?
I'm one of them. I don't know much about them. And again, it's not such literature that I look at, so I'm gonna plead the fifth on this one, or maybe just plead not the fifth, but it won't incriminate me because I don't know enough about it to be incriminated.
If you were in a panel of scientists and they were saying all this is man-made, I would guess you would stand up and say you guys are nuts.
Well, a good panel of scientists would never say that. I mean, that's the nice thing about it. We know it's not all man-made. We know most of the stuff going up in the atmosphere is full of volcanoes. But the truth is that we've added to it, that there would not be the climate change we are seeing if we were just limited to the volcanoes, the internal combustion engine, and the fact that we are liberating so many pockets of methane and other gases because of industrialization. We've added to it, and the percentages, it doesn't matter. The reality is we've added to something that wasn't a problem, and it appears that just that addition is causing things to go out of whack. We're causing temperatures to go up.
Let's go to Brendan in Austin, Texas. Hello, Brendan. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. Thank you so much, sure. Georgie, Professor, and all the listeners. So I had a quick comment. I went to Yellowstone not that long ago, a couple years ago, and it was my first time being there, and all the people that I had asked that live there told me that the animals have been leaving for the past like 20, 30 years. When I went there, there was almost nothing. There was no bison, deer, wolves, bear, geese, everything had left. And they were telling me it's just a fraction of what is left now. And quickly, because we're out of time, before Yellowstone happens, you know, we could do greenhouses underground. And with the whole sea life changing, we're going to have to redo our children's books because almost all the sea life we have are going to be go the way of the unicorns. You know, my children are not going to see lions and tigers out in the world. They're going to be gone. So real quick, my question is that in 1956, the Federal Highway Act that President Eisenhower did, we built all these highways all across America, and it created a nation of drivers. And I was thinking, in preparation for Yellowstone or climate change, we could do a new type of federal aid where we build transit systems all over America to try to blunt the effect of climate change as well as the explosion, the volcano explosion. So I wanted to see your thought about that, of a big government work project, maybe like Hoover Dam or something like that.
If they would get together on that, Peter, go ahead.
I'm not an economist, and just your thoughts are strident too. I mean, I have kids, and I'm about to have grandkids. It's just a case of what will they have to look forward to. On the other hand, the way I try to look at it, there are wonders happening out there that didn't take place in my childhood. There's a lot of stuff that's so much better than it was. In terms of big government fixing things, there are certain things that big government is great at. I mean, the rate at which we got the drugs that are helping so many people survive this pandemic, that's pretty much a miracle. In my lifetime, biologically, that they were able to come up with those shots so quickly was because huge government science, they poured a ton of money into it. Space program, we would have never gotten to the moon if private enterprise had tried it. It was big government. But boy, I don't know, it's just you just can't predict where it's going to work and where it's not. The oceans, there are miracles taking place in the oceans. Big food fish are disappearing, but my favorite animal is the cephalopods. lots of jellyfish, lots of new stuff is appearing. So, yes, it's going to be a new world. Not necessarily a bad world, different world.
Peter, thank you for being on the program. Keep in touch with us and let us pray and keep our fingers crossed that nothing happens at Yellowstone. Up next, why are so many people still skeptical of our landings on the moon? Let's find out.